The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
Good morning. Welcome to the Korea Society and welcome to Studio Korea. We're beginning our second segment of a discussion on the relations among China, Korea, and the United States. With us this morning to help us decipher the realities, the challenges, and opportunities are directly to my left from Fudan University in Shanghai, Professor Shendong Li, Scott Snyder of the Council on Foreign Relations. We have Professor Sung-Yoon Lee from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. We have President Ralph Kossa of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Pacific Forum in Honolulu. And we have John Delury, professor at Yonsei University, and Professor Suki Han, also of Yonsei University. Picking up on where we left off in terms of the discussion and some of the commentary that Professor Shen has said about China and what he regards as some of its infancy and approach, we thought we would turn to the issue of domestic realities in Seoul, in Washington, in Beijing, perhaps in Tokyo. I did want to give the opportunity first for Professor Lee to begin us, to start us off in the second stage of discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. In spring 2005, in March, President Noh Moo-hyun announced that he envisioned South Korea to play the role of balancer in the region. He also mentioned in the aftermath of Japan announcing so-called Takeshima Day on the Tokto territorial issue in March 2005, Noh Moo-hyun said, "We are now on the verge of a diplomatic war with Japan." And his approval rating went from 20 to 40 within a matter of days. Now, while it is my ardent wish to one day see a shrimp balance two whales, it's not going to happen. And at the time, even seasoned diplomats, for instance, former U.S. ambassador to Seoul, a very taciturn, consummate diplomat, told the press, "A lightweight cannot balance a heavyweight." If you were to envision, I won't say who, but if you push me really hard, I might. If you were to envision South Korea playing such a role, a constructive role in the international politics of the region, I think the more appropriate role as an intermediary or mediator is to assume that role in the context of the ongoing Sino-Japanese tension and conflict. As Scott mentioned earlier, this vision of the Park Geun-hye government to play a leading constructive role in forging some kind of a Northeast Asia peace initiative. That is possible, I think, if South Korea were to reach out to Japan and to China as an honest broker, intermediary. Of course, South Korea shares with China that past, the past of having been victimized by Japan. And I think that makes South Korea a more credible intermediary to Beijing. If you were to go in the other direction, one that was laid out by Noh Moo-hyun, of South Korea playing or pursuing equidistant policy vis-a-vis Washington and Beijing, which is what Noh Moo-hyun mentioned many years ago, you are confronted with a philosophical problem. We know that the United States is South Korea's sole ally, the only ally for South Korea. The alliance, as the saying goes, was forged in blood more than 60 years ago. We also know that China and North Korea have a similar intimate relationship alliance also forged in blood on the same occasion 60 years ago. We know that North Korea periodically attacks South Korea. North Korea has, for the past 60 years, launched deadly attacks against South Korea countless times, but always limited and in a controlled way. So North Korea obviously is a threat to South Korea. North Korea's biggest patron is China. South Korea's only patron state is the United States. So within that rhomboid or rectangular relations, it makes no sense for Seoul to assert itself as an honest broker in any incident between Washington and Pyongyang or Washington and Beijing. The view that the new leadership in Beijing will now do the right thing and put some hurt on North Korea seems to have obtained in recent months, both in Seoul and in Washington. In my view, this is an amalgamation of misunderstanding of fundamental Chinese strategic interests in North Korea, also overreading, misreading of complaints, professions of anger toward Pyongyang by various Chinese officials. Now, one day we may see vectors of national interest converge or diverge. That is, we may one day see China wave bye-bye to the political entity called the DPRK, but we are nowhere close to that. And any freezing of North Korean accounts by the Chinese and so forth are all token gestures, or to use a Chinese term, atmospherics. They do not indicate a fundamental shift in Chinese policy, one toward destabilizing North Korea. Of course, externally, the summit between Park Geun-hye and Xi Jinping was dramatic, great success. We saw Bonn Army overflowing in the meetings. But on substance, China made no concession in Korea's interest. The phrase denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula was what was in the joint statement. Now, when you are young and trying to learn a foreign language, one of the first things you learn is to be specific and accurate with subject and object and the verb. Denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. What does that mean? Well, in North Korean parlance, it has a very specific meaning. It means not necessarily denuclearization of North Korea, but dislodging South Korea from the U.S. security umbrella. That's what North Koreans tell us. That's how they view this phrase, which was inserted in the September 19th, 2005 joint statement in the six-party talks. It was a stunning concession by Seoul and Washington at the time. And this is the phrase that pops up in the joint statement by Park Geun-hye and Xi Jinping. Whereas, when Park Geun-hye visited Washington in early May, in the joint statement between Park and Obama, the phrase used is denuclearization of North Korea. So my point here is, yes, Park Geun-hye and Xi Jinping may have some kind of rapport. Xi Jinping and President Obama may have some kind of rapport on a personal level. But civility, courtesy, diplomacy, all wonderful things do not necessarily adumbrate a fundamental shift in Chinese policy.
Oh, please. Ralph.
Well, we want to focus, I guess, on domestic determinants. And I think it's worth noting that democratic systems provide a lot of advantages. The effective conduct of foreign policy is not one of them. And that wasn't something I discovered. You know, de Tocqueville told us that 250 years ago, and we continue to prove it. John mentioned here previously Vice President Biden's comments. I hope that one day American politicians will think about the unintended consequences of slogans. I recall with great flourish Hillary Clinton, America is back, This was supposed to be reassuring. Don't bet against America. The message there is reassuring. But every time you say something, then it's the role of everyone else to overanalyze it. And clearly the Koreans have overanalyzed this if they see that this somehow or other was a zero-sum game between the U.S. and China, as opposed to trying to provide a reassurance that the, quote, relative decline of the United States is just not happening, and don't bet against us. The same point with America is back. Well, that implies that we left. Well, we hadn't left, but it also implies that we're fickle, that we come and go. So then you have to worry about Americans. And of course, why did we come back? Well, every Chinese will tell you the reason we came back was to contain China, because China is growing. So a slogan that really works well in the United States doesn't necessarily play well overseas. And I think, you know, maybe they need some new speechwriters, you know, sort of a foreign speechwriter and a domestic speechwriter, and come up with some new slogans would be very, very helpful. I think, again, the fourth leg of the triangle, Japan, my advice is the Japanese need to start playing the history card, the right history card. The problem in China and in Korea is they seem to think history ended in 1945. But if you look at the history of the second half of the 20th century, there is no country that has more pride in its history than Japan. Why the Japanese leaders seem to think it's important to go back and reinvent the first half of the 20th century, where the debate is over whether Japan was bad, really bad, or really, really bad. Let's talk about the second half of the 20th century, where they were good, or really, really good, and Korea wouldn't be where it is today, and China wouldn't be where it is today economically, were it not for Japanese economic assistance, developmental aid. There's a whole story that needs to be told, and that becomes very difficult because it's a quick way to gain some domestic points in Korea by just sort of playing the anti-Japan card. So from a Korean standpoint, from a Chinese standpoint, at some point they need to take yes for an answer. The U.S., I think, rightfully provided some encouragement to Mr. Abe to try to say the right things. When he did, on the floor of the Diet, essentially reaffirm the Kono statement regarding comfort women, reaffirm the Murayama apology, there wasn't a word of good, let's move forward, in Korea or in China. It wasn't really sincere. Well, if sincerity is the mark of governments, then we're all in a lot of trouble. The point is, I think Japan is trying to move in the right direction, and we need to sort of take that and see the benefits of moving forward. So it's tough. That's why people in charge are called leaders, because they're expected to lead. That requires some political courage. And I think we've seen a lack of political courage in all the countries when it comes to sort of putting history behind and moving forward. And that, to me, is what's really needed.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts on that? Leadership and courage.
Well, I think that that's right. That basically, the antidote to some of the, I mean, basically when we talk about domestic determinants, everybody in their back of their mind is thinking about nationalisms and competing nationalisms, especially where they intersect on issues like territorial claims or debates over history, et cetera. But, you know, really the only way that that is going to be able to overcome is by leaders showing statesmanship and political will to try to, you know, find politically manageable solutions that can help to address those issues. Essentially, it's, you know, an effort to find institutional fixes that can bind and remove those particular issues from being politicized. And I think it's a huge challenge because, you know, the on the other side, especially in democracies and even in one-party systems, public discourse increasingly matters, and the challenges of governance are more difficult. And there's always that temptation to play to the public will. And so, you know, leadership is about recognizing the broader interest over the narrow interest. And I think that that's where we're finding increasingly that it's a real challenge in Northeast Asia.
Other thoughts at the table? Please.
In February this year, DPRK conducted third nuclear test following its satellite launch last December. And in April, it started to threat America and others with a nuclear weapon. It may have not manufactured yet, but to issue threat. Our new president, Xi Jinping, a month after coming into office, made a strong rebuttal to DPRK in Boao Asian Forum. Without naming DPRK, but to speak bluntly that China would not allow others to make trouble outside China's doorstep. New Prime Minister Li Keqiang and a new Foreign Minister Wang Yi made a similar remarks. Under this context, China-U.S. leadership met in Edinburgh in June to discuss how to stabilize and further promote bilateral relationship, because there are lots of stimulants, some emerging destabilizing issues concerning developments in global commons, threats in cyberspace, in maritime space, in outer space, and now we see the airspace, and how to work together collaboratively, not to excite each other, but to work together to defeat threats. And following this, the two countries convened the fifth SAED, Strategic and Economic Dialogue, deciding to have the first China-U.S. cyberspace working group, cybersecurity working group, and a climate change working group to accommodate mutual concern. So I think that China-U.S. Are having increasingly more concern because each other's developments in terms of capacity and intention. But we have found a good way to resolve such concern, because the two presidents would meet in average once 3 or 4 months. They meet 3-4 times a year at G20 or APEC or other meetings like a nuclear security summit or bilateral visits, et cetera, et cetera. Plus numerous phone call in a year. So they have plenty of opportunity to meet, plus many sub-summit meetings. China-U.S. have some 90 government-to-government dialogue institutions available. Many of them would accommodate the threat emerging from Korean Peninsula, namely the nuclear weapon development of not South Korea, but North Korea. Many of us are realistic in viewing that it's too late to denuclearize DPRK. But it's politically wrong if we admit it's too late. It's never too late to work on it. And but we need to offer appearing package for DPRK to accept, which we still fail to search, to discover. But that does not mean we should not work. So I think China and U.S. are increasingly more work wholeheartedly in rendering each other's credibility and resource to the others in a collaborative way, which I think South Koreans believe we are working hard. And someone mentioned that North Korea has used the term denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Sure, generically, this applies to the entire peninsula, but that is to take care North Korean's face in 2005, because they don't want to have their name to be picked up, to be singled out. So to accommodate their face, we say entire Korean Peninsula should be denuclearized. But it's clear South Korea is not a developing nuclear weapon, but South Korea used to develop. America has taken it out. And America has withdrawn its tactical nuclear weapon. Theoretically, North Korea would have a right to inspect the US military base in South Korea to make sure that this base does not host nuclear weapon. With a reciprocal transparency and measurement, if US personnel can go to North Korean's military base to verify. But fundamentally, North Korea is developing a nuissile wherewithal, the fissile material, which is beyond IAEA safeguards, which pose a significant threat. That need to be dealt with. So I think it's a long distance for us to be successful in eliminating DPRK nuclear weapon. But I think China, US, and South Korea are working more wholeheartedly. There is still distance to work more completely sincerely, but working better at this time. So I would say China first does not need to change its position, because our position is already different from the Cultural Revolution position, which is to make the world chaotic, to make China chaotic, to make China poor. Now we want to make China rich, and we hate anyone who would make China poor. It's South Koreans, they invest in China to make China rich. So how we would not be a friend of South Korea? It's America that make us rich. So we would excuse some of Americans' mistake by sending weapon to Taiwan at the moment. Well, so we have lots of common grounds. We can hold on with a difference by working together on wherever we can work. So I'm optimistic that we would adhere to the current position, denuclearizing North Korea in the name of denuclearizing entire peninsula, and to make the region stable, and all of us can be enriched by this good policy.
And we'll get back in the third section to some of the more full discussion of denuclearization. But I did want to give Ralph and Scott a chance to respond.
I can't resist noting that there are 10 million Chinese working in Japanese factories in China today. So I think that
we are also grateful to Japanese investors for this.
But I wanted to ask a question, because I've traveled to China quite frequently, including with our friends from the National Committee. And a term that 5-6 years ago you never heard, which today is the first thing you hear when you have discussions, is public opinion. And particularly, we run a young leaders program where we bring young people in their 20s and early 30s to come to many of our meetings. When I talk to the young Chinese, they are fed up with the government's policy toward North Korea. They're embarrassed by it, and they're very outspoken about it, and they tell me that the netizens, 350 million strong, are very vocal, criticizing the, quote, special relationship between North Korea and China. And I'm just curious, from Ding Li's perspective, what role does public opinion, what role does the netizens play in shaping Chinese policy? Because we tend to think that public opinion wouldn't matter in a one-party system, but there seems to be evidence to the contrary.
Let me ask Denling to respond to that, but also to broaden the question for the table, which is, what do we see in terms of generational shift? Are there new ideas out there among a younger generation of Chinese, Koreans, and for that matter, Americans?
Quick response. I think the government is increasingly more keen internet-based opinion, which is first a change, an improvement, that government is becoming more sensible of people's view. in internet realm, we don't see much sympathizing view of DPRK. And many feel that we are so lucky to rid of our old way of thinking. That is, to make the world chaotic is better, to make us poor is better. And some Chinese are looking forward to opportunity to visit DPRK because we can still see what China lived before and to appreciate how we are proud of what we are having today. And the DPRK would sooner or later change. So better to go DPRK in a hurry because they are going to change. In the meantime, I think government is too sensitive to the internet-based opinion because those opinion leaders would write. Majority of people don't write. I often see, read, I don't write. Very occasionally, I write one or two times to say this is my opinion with my without my name to be seen. Too sensible to internet-based opinion is also not fair because only small amount of people are writing. They do not reflect the majority view. For instance, I once received a phone call from Global Time, which has a name, a nickname, China's Washington Time. Very nationalistic. They said, Professor Shen, how do you interpret our poll, our public opinion of President Obama before he would visit China in 2009? The opinion poll was very bad about Obama. I was very angry. You made a very singular poll. Those people who don't like Obama would vote. Those people who don't care who Obama is or who like him would not vote because it don't allow a space for people who like him to vote. So this is a very singular and unfair poll. I would say your newspaper is too nationalistic, which mislead. If this polling data is published, people would view Obama is bad. But actually, those who feel him bad would feel him bad. And most people, they don't have a view, or they view him differently. Right before his visit to China, even according to Chinese political correctness, we should portray him in a more benign way to let people to have a more rosy picture of China-U.S. relationship. Why negatively? So this is how some media organization would handle this public opinion in a way. I don't think a government should take care. But unfortunately, my government is too much taking care of all this kind of data, which is not scientific. I hope we have to correct in the future.
Other thoughts on social media, generational change, new ideas in foreign policy?
I'll raise something different. Okay. I like talking about aging society.
Aging.
Thank you.
In Korean society, we are just a growing number of the old people because our life expectancy is getting increased. So in my age, maybe we are supposed to live until 90 years old. And at the same time, the growing number of Korean youngsters, they are reluctant to give a birth. So Korean society is getting aging society. This influenced over to the election. So if we take a look at over to the President Park Geun-hye's election, the majority number of 50s and 60s would be the major people who just are voting for the President Park. That would make the kind of a million differences of the voting between the Park Geun-hye and Moon Jae-in. So I think aging society is one of the factors that we have to hit on. Second thing is aging society make government policy a little differentiated from before because we are getting increased our budget for the health and the budget for kind of some people. At the same time, we have to reduce the budget for the military services. So I think that would influence over to the government policies too. And aging society also, it has developed some the people's opinion. I think Korean society is getting more conservative. the aging people, they are more conservative than youngsters. So youngsters, they don't have a, maybe they just maintain a certain level of their kind of occupant, their rates for the government. But I think of the more number of old people, they might have holding the field of the election and the election consequences.
Mm-hmm. Professor Han, thank you. Other thoughts? John?
Well, yeah, I mean, to follow on to Suki's point, you know, it's quite striking when you look at polling data, all of which is, you know, you have to scrutinize, especially in South Korea, but on almost any issue, you see very stark differentiations, you know, generationally. So, for example, I mean, just some polls that I recall that seemed reliable on, I mean, certainly the election numbers were very stark. But also something like a very controversial issue, not as hot now, but, you know, the sinking of the Chonan ship, the audience here would all be familiar with. You know, some of the polls that you saw about question who, you know, whether you trust or distrust the government report on that, the South Korean-led multinational report, and the percentages were, you know, 98% among over 60, and then the number just goes down until you get to 20-year-olds. So you can see that, you know, that's one of the most sensitive sort of foreign policy questions and issues, and you could see that generational change. But then, you know, both Suki and I as teachers interact a lot with our students in their 20s and graduate students in their 30s, and I mean, I see quite a mixture of views, and you don't see, for example, in my experience, you know, young South Koreans don't have the kind of anti-American bent and more radical political bent that they would have in a previous generation. So I think that's quite a different mixture. In fact, in some ways, maybe not by the representatives here, but an older generation of Koreans are more progressive and even radical in their politics than college students in South Korea. So there are some interesting, I think, twists to that generational picture. One general comment I want to make, because, you know, although an American now, I don't get here very often. It is striking to me in conversations like this, we talk especially about nationalism in South Korea and in China. Indeed, you know, as Stephen kindly mentioned, I recently co-authored a book about China, much of which is about nationalism, the history of nationalism. But there's this tendency to talk about their nationalism, the kind of strategic limitations, there's a sort of irrationality about it. But there's almost no discussion in America about American nationalism. Whereas for South Koreans, and for certainly for Chinese, but even for South Koreans, they perceive Americans as essentially just as nationalistic as they are. So I would illustrate that point with, again, drawing from Biden's recent visit, just because it's on my mind. I asked my students, you know, so what did you guys think of the speech? Because many of them were at the speech. And almost all the comments were negative, but the drift of it was, you know, comments like condescending to Koreans, American-centric. And, you know, there was one part in particular where he used the example of U.S. troops in South Korea and said, you know, we've had these troops there for 60 years. He talked about his own family being involved in the military and said, we have no complaints. You know, America has no complaints. And so he used this, we spend billions of dollars, we have our troops there. But the way, say, my students received that was, this is our gift to you, Koreans. You know, we're protecting you. And it was almost the edge of, you should be more grateful. We do it without complaints. Whereas the average Korean, again, a lot of generational differences, is very mixed feelings. There is a level of gratitude to the United States, but it's complicated by the fact that, again, my students see it as America does it because it's in its national interest to do that, and it's not simply spending that money and keeping those troops there just for the good of South Korean people. It's part of the American public's own pursuit of its national interests on a global scale. So, you know, I just think we need to reflect back on whether we're thinking through American public opinion, what drives it, what kind of nationalism we have here, at least in terms of understanding how our foreign policies are perceived in Asia.
Thank you.
May I just quickly add?
Please, Professor Lee.
What is immutable in South Korean politics is ethnic nationalism. When the leader says we're on the verge of a diplomatic war with Japan, or I'm not going to go to the United States just for a photo opportunity, his ratings will go up, as we've seen. And such utterances do wonders for repressed Korean ethnic nationalism. They are a potent palliative for repressed Oedipal complex, the impulse to stand up to Japan and to the United States. And in that context, you can see what a risk it was for Park Chung-hee to normalize relations with Japan in the mid-1960s. From March 1964 until the normalization treaty was signed the following year in June, there were countless protests involving over 100,000 students all across South Korea. So in our day today, something like that would not be possible because South Korea is no longer an authoritarian system. So that is something to be said for the benefits of authoritarianism, benevolent authoritarianism. Today we can't even have a basic agreement between Tokyo and Seoul on limited exchange of military information. I think President Park Geun-hye, although she is vilified from time to time by North Korea and also South Korean radical progressives as dictator's daughter, that is a phrase that often pops up in the Western media as well. And, well, literally, it's a fact that Park Chung-hee was a dictator and Park Geun-hye is Park Chung-hee's daughter. But then, you know, the intention behind such disparagement is that Park Geun-hye lacks qualifications of her own, and by the sole virtue of being a daughter of Park Chung-hee, won the presidential election. But that puts one in a quandary, that formulation, because the only logical conclusion you can reach with that formulation is Park Chung-hee, although he was a dictator, was such a great leader, his daughter, who lacks qualifications of her own, in the end won the presidency. If you see what I mean. So dictator's daughter is more a reflection of alliteration, something like Dunkin' Donuts or Donald Duck, than anything else. But Park Geun-hye has an opportunity to, well, act like a statesman, I think next year in 2014, to borrow a Chinese phrase, to Sung Jiu Ying Xin, to let go of the old and greet the new, and really reach out to Tokyo, because not only does South Korea share same interests, not only do the countries have shared interests and values, democracy, South Korea had a rude awakening. It was mentioned earlier that South Korea had a rude awakening upon China's recent unilateral declaration of the defense identification zone. But the real rude awakening came on October 3rd, when Secretary Kerry and Secretary Hagel in Tokyo resorted to dramatic gesture to elevate, to reinforce the alliance, not only in terms of gesture, but on substance as well. It was a testament to this, you know, pronouncement of expanded role for Japan in the regional security apparatus, specifics like sharing information on space and cyber warfare and so forth. And also the statement by the two men in Tokyo, sort of a 1-2 punch, to use a crude boxing analogy, Kerry mentioning that we recognize that senkakus are under Japan's administration, which Hagel followed up with, we are treaty-bound to defend Japan. That was a message that the import of which should have not been lost on Seoul. Because for some years now, Seoul has harbored the illusion that, hey, maybe the U.S. likes us more than Japan. And that presumption was based mostly on this use of the word linchpin that was first applied to South Korea a few years ago by the Obama administration. In sum, I think conditions will be more favorable in terms of resumed talks at the highest level between Seoul and Tokyo next year. And I think the political hurdles that may deter Park Geun-hye from talking to Japan today are not nearly as high as those in 1964 and 1965. A few years ago, there was a survey in South Korea in the summer of 2007, and the majority of respondents who were elementary school students replied to the question, who were the major combatants in the Korean War? South Korea and Japan. So this is an immutable fact. Anti-Japanese sentiment as a repressed, latent feeling will not go away anytime soon, but President Park Geun-hye has to overcome such hurdles and reach out to Japan, and I think she will next year.
Scott Snyder, would you like to close out the segment for us?
Yeah, in fact, what I'd like to do is sum up what I think has been a very useful discussion that I think has challenged, to some extent, conventional wisdom out there that nationalism is the driver for potential conflict in East Asia. But I think that what we see in all of these societies, and also in the United States, is that it may actually be that demographic pressures are shifting the relative emphasis of leadership politically toward the domestic and away from the international. And as a result, maybe these demographic pressures are, you know, revealing that the gaps in international could be, you know, the threat as all of the governments face an increasing need to grapple with serious domestic challenges of their own, some of which are connected to this demographic set of trends in aging societies.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Scott.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.